6. At 8 o'clock, Dr. Copeland sat at his desk, studying a sheaf of papers by the bleak morning light from the window. Beside him, the tree, a thick fringed cedar, rose up dark and green to the ceiling. Since the first year he began to practice, he had given an annual party on Christmas Day, and now all was in readiness. Rows of benches and chairs lined the walls of the front rooms. Throughout the house, there was the sweet, spiced odor of newly baked cake and steaming coffee. In the office with him, Portia sat on a bench against the wall, her hands cupped beneath her chin, her body bent almost double. "Father, you've been scrooched over the desk since 5 o'clock. You got no business to be up. You ought to stayed in bed until time for the to-do." Dr. Copeland moistened his thick lips with his tongue. So much was on his mind that he had no attention to give to Portia. Her presence fretted him. At last he turned to her irritably.
"Why do you sit there moping?"
"I just got worried," she said. "For one thing, I worried about our Willie."
"William?"
"You see, he been writing me regular every Sunday. The letter will get here on Monday or Tuesday. But last week he didn't write. Course, I'm not really anxious. Willie, he always so good-natured and sweet, I know he gonna be all right. He been transferred from the prison to the chain gang, and they're gonna work up somewhere north of Atlanta. 2 weeks ago, he wrote this here letter to say they're going to attend a church service today, and he done asked me to send him his suit of clothes and his red tie."
"Is that all William said?"
"He written that this Mr. B.F. Mason is at that prison, too, and that he run into Buster Johnson, he a boy Willie used to know. And also he done asked me to please send him his harp, because he can't be happy without he got his harp to play on. I done sent everything. Also a checker set and a white ice cake, but I sure hope I hears from him in the next few days." Dr. Copeland's eyes glowed with fever, and he could not rest his hands.
"Daughter, we shall have to discuss this later. It is getting late, and I must finish here. You go back to the kitchen and see that all is ready."
Portia stood up and tried to make her face bright and happy. "What you done decided about that $5 prize?"
"As yet, I have been unable to decide just what is the wisest course," he said carefully.
A certain friend of his, a Negro pharmacist, gave an award of $5 every year to the high school student who wrote the best essay on a given subject. The pharmacist always made Dr. Copeland sole judge of the papers, and the winner was announced at the Christmas party. The subject of the composition this year was My Ambition, How I Can Better the Position of the Negro Race in Society. There was only one essay worthy of real consideration. Yet this paper was so childish and ill-advised that it would hardly be prudent to confer upon it the award. Dr. Copeland put on his glasses and reread the essay with deep concentration. "This is my ambition. First, I wish to attend Tuskegee College, but I do not wish to be a man like Booker Washington or Dr. Carver. Then, when I deem that my education is complete, I wish to start off being a fine lawyer like the one who defended the Scottsboro boys. I would only take cases for colored people against white people. Every day our people are made in every way and by every means to feel that they are inferior. This is not so. We are a rising race, and we cannot sweat beneath the white man's burdens for long. We cannot always sow where others reap. I want to be like Moses, who led the children of Israel from the land of the oppressors. I want to get up a secret organization of colored leaders and scholars. All colored people will organize under the direction of these picked leaders and prepare for revolt. Other nations in the world who are interested in the plight of our race and who would like to see the United States divided would come to our aid. All colored people will organize, and there will be a revolution. And at the close, colored people will take up all the territory east of the Mississippi and south of the Potomac. I shall set up a mighty country under the control of the organization of colored leaders and scholars. No white person will be allowed a passport, and if they get into the country, they will have no legal rights. I hate the whole white race and will work always so that the colored race can achieve revenge for all their sufferings. That is my ambition." Dr. Copeland felt the fever warm in his veins. The ticking of the clock on his desk was loud, and the sound jarred his nerves. How could he give the award to a boy with such wild notions as this? What should he decide? The other essays were without any firm content at all. The young people would not think. They wrote only about their ambitions and omitted the last part of the title altogether. Only one point was of some significance. 9 out of the lot of 25 began with the sentence, "I do not want to be a servant." After that, they wished to fly airplanes, to be prize fighters or preachers or dancers. One girl's sole ambition was to be kind to the poor. The writer of the essay that troubled him was Lancey Davis. He had known the identity of the author before he turned the last sheet over and saw the signature. Already he had some trouble with Lancey. His older sister had gone out to work as a servant when she was 11 years old, and she had been raped by her employer, a white man past middle age. Then a year or so later, he had received an emergency call to attend Lancey. Dr. Copeland went to the filing case in his bedroom where he kept notes on all of his patients. He took out the card marked Mrs. Dan Davis and family and glanced through the notations until he reached Lancey's name. The date was 4 years ago. The entries on him were written with more care than the others and in ink. 13 years old, past puberty, unsuccessful attempt, self-emasculation, oversexed, and hyperthyroid. Wept boisterously during 2 visits, though little pain. Voluble, very glad to talk, though paranoiac. Environment fair, with one exception. See Lucy Davis, mother, washerwoman. Intelligent and well worth watching, and all possible help. Keep contact. Fee, $1. ? It is a difficult decision to make this year, he said to Portia. But I suppose I will have to confer the award on Lancey Davis.
If you done decide, then come tell me about some of these here presents.
The gifts to be distributed at the party were in the kitchen. There were paper sacks of groceries and clothing, all marked with a red Christmas card. Anyone who cared to come was invited to the party, but those who meant to attend had stopped by the house and written or had asked a friend to write their names in a guest book kept on the table in the hall for that purpose. The sacks were piled on the floor. There were about 40 of them, each one depending in size on the need of the receiver. Some gifts were only small packages of nuts or raisins, and others were boxes almost too heavy for a man to lift. The kitchen was crowded with good things. Dr. Copeland stood in the doorway, and his nostrils quivered with pride.
I think you've done right well this year. Folks certainly have been kindly.
Pshaw, he said. This is not 1/100th part of what is needed.
Now there you go, Father. I know good and well you just as pleased as you can be. But you don't want to show it. You gotta find something to grumble about. Here we have about 4 pecks apiece, 20 sacks a meal, about 15 pounds of side meat, mullet, 6 dozen eggs, plenty of grits, jars of tomatoes and peaches, apples and 2 dozen oranges, also garments and 2 mattresses and 4 blankets. I call this something.
A drop in the bucket.
Portia pointed to a large box in the corner.
These here. What you intend to do with them?
The box contained nothing but junk. A headless doll, some dirty lace, a rabbit skin. Dr. Copeland scrutinized each article.
Do not throw them away. There is use for everything. These are the gifts from our guests who have nothing better to contribute. I will find some purpose for them later.
Suppose you look over these here boxes and sacks so I can commence to tie them up. There ain't gonna be room in here in the kitchen. Time they all pile in for the refreshments. I just gonna put these here presents out on the back steps and in the yard.
The morning sun had risen. The day would be bright and cold. In the kitchen, there were rich, sweet odors. A dishpan of coffee was on the stove, and iced cakes filled a shelf in the cupboard. And none of this comes from white people, all from colored.
No, said Dr. Copeland. That is not wholly true. Mr. Singer contributed a check for $12 to be used for coal, and I have invited him to be present today.
Holy Jesus, Portia said, $12?
I felt that it was proper to ask him. He is not like other people of the Caucasian race.
You right, Portia said. But I keep thinking about my Willie. I sure wish he could enjoy this here party today, and I sure wish I could get a letter from him. It just prey on my mind. But here, I's gotta quit this here talking and get ready. It mighty near time for the party to come.
Time enough remained. Dr. Copeland washed and clothed himself carefully. For a while, he tried to rehearse what he would say when the people had all come, but expectation and restlessness would not let him concentrate. Then at 10 o'clock, the first guests arrived, and within half an hour, they were all assembled.
Joyful Christmas to you, said John Roberts, the postman. He moved happily about the crowded room, one shoulder held higher than the other, mopping his face with a white silk handkerchief. Many happy returns of the day.
The front of the house was thronged. Guests were blocked at the door, and they formed groups on the front porch and in the yard. There was no pushing or rudeness. The turmoil was orderly. Friends called out to each other, and strangers were introduced and clasped hands. Children and young people clotted together and moved back toward the kitchen.
Christmas gift!
Dr. Copeland stood in the center of the front room by the tree. He was dizzy. He shook hands and answered salutations with confusion. Personal gifts, some tied elaborately with ribbons and others wrapped in newspaper, were thrust into his hands. He could find no place to put them. The air thickened and voices grew louder. Faces whirled about him so that he could recognize no one. His composure returned to him gradually. He found space to lay aside the presents in his arms. The dizziness lessened. The room cleared. He settled his spectacles and began to look around him.
Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!
There was Marshall Nichols, the pharmacist, in a long-tailed coat, conversing with his son-in-law, who worked on a garbage truck. The preacher from the Most Holy Ascension Church had come, and two deacons from other churches. Highboy, wearing a loud-checked suit, moved sociably through the crowd. Husky young dandies bowed to young women in long, bright-colored dresses. There were mothers with children, and deliberate old men who spat into gaudy handkerchiefs. The room was warm and noisy. Mr. Singer stood in the doorway. Many people stared at him. Dr. Copeland could not remember if he had welcomed him or not. The mute stood by himself. His face resembled somewhat a picture of Spinoza, a Jewish face. It was good to see him. The doors and the windows were open. Drafts blew through the room so that the fire roared. The noises quieted. The seats were all filled, and the young people sat in rows on the floor. The hall, the porch, even the yard were crowded with silent guests. The time had come for him to speak, and what was he to say? Panic tightened his throat. The room waited. At a sign from John Roberts, all sounds were hushed.
My people, began Dr. Copeland blankly. There was a pause.
Then suddenly, the words came to him.
This is the 19th year that we have gathered together in this room to celebrate Christmas Day. When our people first heard of the birth of Jesus Christ, it was a dark time. Our people were sold as slaves in this town, on the courthouse square. Since then, we have heard and told the story of his life more times than we could remember. So today, our story will be a different one. 120 years ago, another man was born in the country that is known as Germany, a country far across the Atlantic Ocean. This man understood, as did Jesus, But his thoughts were not concerned with heaven or the future of the dead. His mission was for the living, for the great masses of human beings who work and suffer and work until they die, for people who take in washing and work as cooks, who pick cotton and work at the hot dye vats of the factories. His mission was for us, and the name of this man was Karl Marx. Karl Marx was a wise man. He studied and worked and understood the world around him. He said that the world was divided into two classes, the poor and the rich. For every rich man, there were 1,000 poor people who worked for this rich man to make him richer. He did not divide the world into Negroes or white people or Chinese. To Karl Marx, it seemed that being one of the millions of poor people or one of the few rich was more important to a man than the color of his skin. The life mission of Karl Marx was to make all human beings equal and to divide the great wealth of the world so that there would be no poor or rich, and each person would have his share. This is one of the commandments Karl Marx left to us. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. A wrinkled yellow palm waved timidly from the hall.
Were he the Mark in the Bible? Dr. Copeland explained.
He spelled the two names and cited dates.
Are there any more questions? I wish each one of you to feel free to start or enter into any discussion.
I presume Mr. Marx was a Christian churchman, asked the preacher.
He believed in the holiness of the human spirit.
Were he a white man?
Yes, but he did not think of himself as a white man. He said, I consider nothing human as alien to myself. He thought of himself as a brother to all people.
Dr. Copeland paused a moment longer. The faces around him were waiting.
What is the value of any piece of property, of any merchandise we buy in a store? The value depends only on one thing. And that is the work it took to make or to raise this article. Why does a brick house cost more than a cabbage? Because the work of many men goes into the making of one brick house. There are the people who made the bricks and mortar, and the people who cut down the trees to make the planks used for the floor. There are the men who made the building of the brick house possible. There are the men who carried the materials to the ground where the house was to be built. There are the men who made the wheelbarrows and the trucks that carried the materials to this place. Then finally, there are the workmen who built the house. A brick house involves the labor of many, many people, while any of us can raise a cabbage in his backyard. A brick house costs more than a cabbage, because it takes more work to make. So when a man buys this brick house, he is paying for the labor that went to make it. But who gets the money, the profit? Not the many men who did the work, but the bosses who control them. And if you study this further, you will find that these bosses have bosses above them, and those bosses have bosses higher up, so that the real people who control all this work, which makes any article worth money, are very few. Is this clear so far?
Us understand.
But did they? He started all over and retold what he had said. This time there were questions.
But don't clay for these here bricks cost money? And don't it take money to rent land and raise crops on?
That is a good point, said Dr. Copeland. Land, clay, timber, those things are called natural resources. Man does not make these natural resources. Man only develops them, only uses them for work. Therefore, should any one person or group of persons own these things? How can a man own ground and space and sunlight and rain for crops? How can a man say, "This is mine," about those things and refuse to let others share them? Therefore, Marx says that these natural resources should belong to everyone, not divided into little pieces, but used by all the people according to their ability to work. It is like this. Say a man died and left his mule to his four sons. The sons would not wish to cut up the mule into four parts and each take his share. They would own and work the mule together. That is the way Marx says all of the natural resources should be owned, not by one group of rich people, but by all the workers of the world as a whole. We in this room have no private properties. Perhaps one or two of us may own the homes we live in or have a dollar or two set aside, but we own nothing that does not contribute directly toward keeping us alive. All that we own is our bodies, and we sell our bodies every day we live. We sell them when we go out in the morning to our jobs, and when we labor all day, we are forced to sell at any price, at any time, for any purpose. We are forced to sell our bodies so that we can eat and live. And the price which is given us for this is only enough so that we will have the strength to labor longer for the profits of others. Today, we are not put up on the platforms and sold at the courthouse square, but we are forced to sell our strength, our time, our souls during almost every hour that we live. We have been freed from one kind of slavery only to be delivered into another. Is this freedom? Are we yet free men? A deep voice called out from the front yard, "That the real truth, the how things is." And we are not alone in this slavery. There are millions of others throughout the world of all colors and races and creeds. This we must remember. There are many of our people who hate the poor of the white race, and they hate us. The people in this town living by the river, who work in the mills, people who are almost as much in need as we are ourselves. This hatred is a great evil, and no good can ever come from it. We must remember the words of Karl Marx and see the truth according to his teachings. The injustice of need must bring us all together and not separate us. We must remember that we all make the things of this earth of value because of our labor. These main truths from Karl Marx we must keep in our hearts always and not forget. But my people, we in this room, we Negroes, have another mission that is for ourselves alone. Within us there is a strong, true purpose, and if we fail in this purpose, we will be forever lost. Let us see, then, what is the nature of this special mission. Dr. Copeland loosened the collar of his shirt, for in his throat there was a choked feeling. The grievous love he felt within him was too much. He looked around him at the hushed guests. They waited. The groups of people in the yard and on the porch stood with the same quiet attention as did those in the room. A deaf old man leaned forward with his hand to his ear. A woman hushed a fretful baby with a pacifier. Mr. Singer stood attentively in the doorway.
Most of the young people sat on the floor. Among them was Lancey Davis. The boy's lips were nervous and pale. He clasped his knees very tightly with his arms, and his young face was sullen. All the eyes in the room watched, and in them there was hunger for truth.
"Today, we are to confer the $5 award upon the high school student who wrote the best essay on the topic, My Ambition, How I Can Better the Position of the Negro Race in Society. This year, the award goes to Lancey Davis."
Dr. Copeland took an envelope from his pocket.
"There is no need for me to tell you that the value of this award is not wholly in the sum of money it represents, but the sacred trust and faith that goes with it."
Lancey rose awkwardly to his feet. His sullen lips trembled. He bowed and accepted the award.
"Do you wish me to read the essay I have written?"
"No," said Dr. Copeland. "But I wish you to come and talk with me sometime this week."
"Yes, sir."
The room was quiet again.
"I do not wish to be a servant. That is the desire I have read over and over in these essays. Servant? Only 1 in 1,000 of us is allowed to be a servant. We do not work. We do not serve."
The laughter in the room was uneasy.
"Listen. 1 out of 5 of us labors to build roads, or to take care of the sanitation of the city, or works in a sawmill, or on a farm. Another 1 out of 5 is unable to get any work at all. But the other 3 out of 5, the greatest number of our people, many of us cook for those who are incompetent to prepare the food that they themselves eat. Many work a lifetime tending flower gardens for the pleasure of 1 or 2 people. Many of us polish slick waxed floors or fine houses, or we drive automobiles for rich people who are too lazy to drive themselves. We spend our lives doing thousands of jobs that are of no real use to anybody. We labor, and all of our labor is wasted. Is that service? No, that is slavery. We labor, but our labor is wasted. We are not allowed to serve. You students here this morning represent the fortunate few of our race. Most of our people are not allowed to go to school at all. For each one of you, there are dozens of young people who can hardly write their names. We are denied the dignity of study and wisdom. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. All of us here know what it is to suffer for real need. That is a great injustice. But there is one injustice bitterer even than that: to be denied the right to work according to one's ability. To labor a lifetime uselessly. To be denied the chance to serve. It is far better for the profits of our purse to be taken from us than to be robbed of the riches of our minds and souls. Some of you young people here this morning may feel the need to be teachers or nurses or leaders of your race, but most of you will be denied. You will have to sell yourselves for a useless purpose in order to keep alive. You will be thrust back and defeated. The young chemist picks cotton. The young writer is unable to learn to read. The teacher is held in useless slavery at some ironing board. We have no representatives in government. We have no vote. In all of this great country, we are the most oppressed of all people. We cannot lift up our voices. Our tongues rot in our mouths from lack of use. Our hearts grow empty and lose strength for our purpose.
people of the Negro race. We bring with us all the riches of the human mind and soul. We offer the most precious of all gifts, and our offerings are held in scorn and contempt. Our gifts are trampled in the mud and made useless. We are put to labor more useless than the work of beasts. Negroes, we must arise and be whole again. We must be free.
In the room, there was a murmur. Hysteria mounted. Dr. Copeland choked and clenched his fists. He felt as though he had swelled up to the size of a giant. The love in him made his chest a dynamo, and he wanted to shout so that his voice could be heard throughout the town. He wanted to fall upon the floor and call out in a giant voice. The room was full of moans and shouts. Save us, mighty Lord! Lead us from this wilderness of death! Hallelujah! Save us, Lord! He struggled for the control in him. He struggled, and at last the discipline returned. He pushed down the shout in him and sought for the strong, true voice.
Attention, he called. We will save ourselves, but not by prayers of mourning, not by indolence or strong drink, not by the pleasures of the body or by ignorance, not by submission and humbleness, but by pride. By dignity, by becoming hard and strong, we must build strength for our real, true purpose.
He stopped abruptly and held himself very straight.
Each year at this time, we illustrate, in our small way, the first commandment from Karl Marx. Every one of you at this gathering has brought in advance some gift. Many of you have denied yourselves comfort that the needs of others may be lessened. Each of you has given according to his best ability, without thought to the value of the gift he will receive in return. It is natural for us to share with each other. We have long realized that it is more blessed to give than to receive. The words of Karl Marx have always been known in our hearts, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs.
Dr. Copeland was silent a long time, as though his words were complete. Then he spoke again.
Our mission is to walk with strength and dignity through the days of our humiliation. Our pride must be strong, for we know the value of the human mind and soul. We must teach our children. We must sacrifice so that they may earn the dignity of study and wisdom. For the time will come. The time will come when the riches in us will not be held in scorn and contempt. The time will come when we will be allowed to serve, when we will labor, and our labor will not be wasted. And our mission is to await this time with strength and faith.
It was finished. Hands were clapped, feet were stamped upon the floor, and on the hard winter ground outside. The odor of hot, strong coffee floated from the kitchen. John Roberts took charge of the presents, calling out the names written on the cards. Portia ladled the coffee from the dishpan on the stove while Marshall Nichols passed slices of cake. Dr. Copeland moved about among the guests, a little crowd always surrounding him. Someone nagged at his elbow.
He the one your buddy named for?
He answered yes. Lancey Davis followed him with questions. He answered yes to everything. The joy made him feel like a drunken man. To teach and exhort and explain to his people and to have them understand, that was the best of all, to speak the truth and be attended. I certainly have had one fine time at this party. He stood in the vestibule saying goodbye. Over and over he shook hands. He leaned heavily against the wall, and only his eyes moved, for he was tired. I certainly do appreciate. Mr. Singer was the last to leave. He was a truly good man. He was a white man of intellect and true knowledge. In him, there was none of the mean insolence. When all had departed, he was the last to remain. He waited and seemed to expect some final word. Dr. Copeland held his hand to his throat because his larynx was sore.
Teachers, he said huskily, that is our greatest need. Leaders, someone to unite and guide us.
After the festivity, the rooms had a bare, ruined look. The house was cold. Portia was washing the cups in the kitchen. The silver snow on the Christmas tree had been tracked over the floors, and two of the ornaments were broken. He was tired, but the joy and the fever would not let him rest. Beginning with the bedroom, he set to work to put the house in order. On the top of the filing case, there was a loose card, the note on Lancey Davis. The words that he would say to him began to form in his mind, and he was restless because he could not speak them now. The boy's sullen face was full of heart, and he could not thrust it from his thoughts. He opened the top drawer of the file to replace the card. A, B, C, he thumbed through the letters nervously. Then his eye was fixed on his own name, Copeland, Benedict Maddie. In the folder were several lung x-rays and a short case history. He held an x-ray up to the light. On the upper left lung, there was a bright place like a calcified star, and lower down, a large clouded spot that duplicated itself in the right lung, farther up. Dr. Copeland quickly replaced the x-rays in the folder. Only the brief notes he had written on himself were still in his hand. The words stretched out large and scrawling so that he could hardly read them. 1920 calcification of lymph glands. Very pronounced thickening of Healy. Lesions arrested. Duties resumed. 1937 lesion reopened, x-ray shows. He could not read the notes. At first he could not make out the words, and then, when he read them clearly, they made no reason. At the finish there were three words. Prognosis, don't know. The old black, violent feeling came in him again. He leaned down and wrenched open a drawer at the bottom of the case. A jumbled pile of letters, notes from the Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a yellowed letter from Daisy, a note from Hamilton asking for $1.50. What was he looking for? His hands rummaged in the drawer, and then at last he arose stiffly. Time wasted. The past hour gone. Portia peeled potatoes at the kitchen table. She was slumped over, and her face was dolorous.
Hold up your shoulders, he said angrily, and cease moping. You mope and drool around until I cannot bear to look on you.
I was just thinking about Willie, she said. Course, the letter's only 3 days due, but he got no business to worry me like this. He's not that kind of boy. And I got this queer feeling.
Have patience, daughter.
I reckon I have to.
There are a few calls I must make, but I will be back shortly.
Okay.
All will be well, he said.
Most of his joy was gone in the bright, cool noonday sun. The diseases of his patients lay scattered in his mind. An abscessed kidney, spinal meningitis, Pott's disease. He lifted the crank of the automobile from the back seat. Usually he hailed some passing Negro from the street to crank the car for him. His people were always glad to help and serve. But today he fitted the crank and turned it vigorously himself. He wiped the perspiration from his face with the sleeve of his overcoat and hurried to get beneath the wheel and on his way. How much that he had said today was understood? How much would be of any value? He recalled the words he had used, and they seemed to fade and lose their strength. The words left unsaid were heavier on his heart. They rolled up to his lips and fretted them. The faces of his suffering people moved in a swelling mass before his eyes. And as he steered the automobile slowly down the street, his heart turned with this angry, restless love. 7. The town had not known a winter as cold as this one for years. Frost formed on the window panes and whitened the roofs of houses. The winter afternoons glowed with a hazy lemon light, and shadows were a delicate blue. A thin coat of ice crusted the puddles in the streets, and it was said on the day after Christmas that only 10 miles to the north there was a light fall of snow. A change came over Singer. Often he went out for the long walks that had occupied him during the months when Antonopolis was first gone. These walks extended for miles in every direction and covered the whole of the town. He rambled through the dense neighborhoods along the river that were more squalid than ever since the mills had been slack this winter. In many eyes, there was a look of somber loneliness. Now that people were forced to be idle, a certain restlessness could be felt. There was a fervid outbreak of new beliefs. A young man who had worked at the dye vats in a mill claimed suddenly that a great holy power had come in him. He said it was his duty to deliver a new set of commandments from the Lord. The young man set up a tabernacle, and hundreds of people came each night to roll on the ground and shake each other, for they believed that they were in the presence of something more than human. There was murder, too. A woman who could not make enough to eat believed that a foreman had cheated on her work tokens, and she stabbed him in the throat. A family of Negroes moved into the end house on one of the most dismal streets, and this caused so much indignation that the house was burned and the black man beaten by his neighbors. But these were incidents. Nothing had really changed. The strike that was talked about never came off because they could not get together. All was the same as before. Even on the coldest nights, the Sunny Dixie Show was open. The people dreamed and fought and slept as much as ever, and by habit they shortened their thoughts so that they would not wander out into the darkness beyond tomorrow. Singer walked through the scattered, odorous parts of town where the Negroes crowded together. There was more gaiety and violence here. Often the fine, sharp smell of gin lingered in the alleys. Warm, sleepy firelight colored the windows. Meetings were held in the churches almost every night. Comfortable little houses set off in plots of brown grass. Singer walked in these parts also. Here the children were huskier and more friendly to strangers. He roamed through the neighborhoods of the rich. There were houses very grand and old, with white columns and intricate fences of wrought iron. He walked past the big brick houses where automobiles honked in the driveways and where the plumes of smoke rolled lavishly from chimneys, and out to the very edges of the roads that led from the town to general stores where farmers came on Saturday nights and sat around the stove. He wandered often about the four main business blocks that were brightly lighted and then through the black, deserted alleys behind. There was no part of the town that Singer did not know. He watched the yellow squares of light reflect from 1,000 windows. The winter nights were beautiful. The sky was a cold azure, and the stars were very bright. Often it happened now that he would be spoken to and stopped during these walks. All kinds of people became acquainted with him. If the person who spoke to him was a stranger, Singer presented his card so that his silence would be understood. He came to be known through all the town. He walked with his shoulders very straight and kept his hands always stuffed down into his pockets. His gray eyes seemed to take in everything around him, and in his face there was still the look of peace that is seen most often in those who are very wise or very sorrowful. He was always glad to stop with anyone wishing his company, for after all he was only walking and going nowhere. Now it came about that various rumors started in the town concerning the mute. In the years before, with Antonopoulos, they had walked back and forth to work, but except for this, they were always alone together in their rooms. No one had bothered about them then, and if they were observed, it was the big Greek on whom attention was focused. The singer of those years was forgotten. So the rumors about the mute were rich and varied. The Jews said that he was a Jew. The merchants along the main street claimed he had received a large legacy and was a very rich man. It was whispered in one brow-beaten textile union that the mute was an organizer for the CIO. A lone Turk who had roamed into the town years ago and who languished with his family behind the little store where they sold linens claimed passionately to his wife that the mute was Turkish. He said that when he spoke his language, the mute understood. And as he claimed this, his voice grew warm, and he forgot to squabble with his children, and he was full of plans and activity. One old man from the country said that the mute had come from somewhere near his home, and that the mute's father had the finest tobacco crop in all the county. All these things were said about him. Antonopoulos. Within Singer there was always the memory of his friend. At night, when he closed his eyes, the Greek's face was there in the darkness, round and oily, with a wise and gentle smile. In his dreams, they were always together. It was more than a year now since his friend had gone away. This year seemed neither long nor short. Rather, it was removed from the ordinary sense of time, as when one is drunk or half asleep. Behind each hour, there was always his friend. And this buried life with Antonopoulos changed and developed, as did the happenings around him. During the first few months, he had thought most of the terrible weeks before Antonopoulos was taken away, of the trouble that followed his illness, of the summons for arrest, and the misery in trying to control the whims of his friend. He thought of times in the past when he and Antonopoulos had been unhappy. There was one recollection, far in the past, that came back to him several times. They never had no friends. Sometimes they would meet other mutes. There were three of them with whom they became acquainted during the 10 years. But something always happened. One moved to another state the week after they met him. Another was married and had 6 children and did not talk with his hands. But it was their relation with the third of these acquaintances that Singer remembered when his friend was gone. The mute's name was Carl. He was a sallow young man who worked in one of the mills. His eyes were pale yellow, and his teeth so brittle and transparent that they seemed pale and yellow also. In his blue overalls that hung limp over his skinny little body, he was like a blue and yellow rag doll. They invited him to dinner and arranged to meet him beforehand at the store where Antonopoulos worked. The Greek was still busy when they arrived. He was finishing a batch of caramel fudge in the cooking room at the back of the store. The fudge lay golden and glossy over the long marble-topped table. The air was warm and rich with sweet smells. Antonopoulos seemed pleased to have Carl watch him as he glided the knife down the warm candy and cut it into squares. He offered their new friend a corner of the fudge on the edge of his greased knife and showed him the trick that he always performed for anyone when he wished to be liked. He pointed to a vat of syrup boiling on the stove and fanned his face and squinted his eyes to show how hot it was. Then he wet his hand in a pot of cold water, plunged it into the boiling syrup, and swiftly put it back into the water again. His eyes bulged and he rolled out his tongue as though he were in great agony. He even wrung his hand and hopped on one foot so that the building shook. Then he smiled suddenly and held out his hand to show that it was a joke, and hit Carl on the shoulder. It was a pale winter evening, and their breath clouded in the cold air as they walked with their arms interlocked down the street. Singer was in the middle, and he left them on the sidewalk twice while he went into stores to shop. Carl and Antonopoulos carried the sacks of groceries, and Singer held to their arms tightly and smiled all the way home. Their rooms were cozy, and he moved happily about, making conversation with Carl. After the meal, the two of them talked while Antonopoulos watched with a slow smile. Often the big Greek would lumber to the closet and pour out drinks of gin. Carl sat by the window, only drinking when Antonopoulos pushed the glass into his face, and then taking solemn little sips. Singer could not ever remember his friend so cordial to a stranger before, and he thought ahead with pleasure to the time when Carl would visit them often. Midnight had passed when the thing happened that ruined the festive party. Antonopoulos returned from one of his trips to the closet, and his face had a glowering look. He sat on his bed and began to stare repeatedly at their new friend with expressions of offense and great disgust. Singer tried to make eager conversation to hide the strange behavior, but the Greek was persistent. Carl huddled in a chair, nursing his bony knees, fascinated and bewildered by the grimaces of the big Greek. His face was flushed, and he swallowed timidly. Singer could ignore the situation no longer, so at last he asked Antonopoulos if his stomach pained him, or if he perhaps felt bad and wished to go to sleep. Antonopoulos shook his head. He pointed to Carl and began to make all the gestures of obscenity which he knew. The disgust on his face was terrible to see. Carl was small with fear. At last the big Greek ground his teeth and rose from his chair. Hurriedly, Carl picked up his cap and left the room. Singer followed him down the stairs. He did not know how to explain his friend to this stranger. Carl stood hunched in the doorway downstairs, limp, with his peaked cap pulled down over his face. At last, they shook hands, and Carl went away. Antonopoulos let him know that while they were not noticing, their guest had gone into the closet and drunk up all the gin. No amount of persuasion could convince Antonopoulos that it was he himself who had finished the bottle. The big Greek sat up in bed, and his round face was dismal and reproachful. Large tears trickled slowly down to the neck of his undershirt, and he could not be comforted. At last, he went to sleep, but Singer was awake in the dark a long time. They never saw Carl again. Then years later, there was the time Antonopoulos took the rent money from the vase on the mantelpiece and spent it all on the slot machines. And the summer afternoon, Antonopoulos went downstairs naked to get the paper. He suffered so from the summer heat. They bought an electric refrigerator on the installment plan, and Antonopoulos would suck the cubes of ice constantly and even let a few of them melt in bed with him as he slept. And the time Antonopoulos got drunk and threw a bowl of macaroni in his face. Those ugly memories wove through his thoughts during the first months like bad threads through a carpet. And then they were gone. All the times that they had been unhappy were forgotten. For as the year went on, his thoughts of his friends spiraled deeper until he dwelt only with the Antonopoulos whom he alone could know. This was the friend to whom he told all that was in his heart. This was the Antonopoulos who no one knew was wise but him. As the year passed, his friends seemed to grow larger in his mind, and his face looked out in a very grave and subtle way from the darkness at night. The memories of his friend changed in his mind so that he remembered nothing that was wrong or foolish, only the wise and good. He saw Antonopoulos sitting in a large chair before him. He sat tranquil and unmoving. His mad face was inscrutable. His mouth was wise and smiling, and his eyes were profound. He watched the things that were said to him, and in his wisdom he understood. This was the Antonopoulos who now was always in his thoughts. This was the friend to whom he wanted to tell things that had come about, for something had happened in this year. He had been left in an alien land, alone. He had opened his eyes, and around him there was much he could not understand. He was bewildered. He watched the word shape on their lips.
"We Negroes want a chance to be free at last,"
and freedom is only the right to contribute. We want to serve and to share, to labor and in turn consume that which is due to us. But you are the only white man I have ever encountered who realizes this terrible need of my people.
You see, Mr. Singer, I got this music in me all the time. I gotta be a real musician. Maybe I don't know anything now, but I will when I'm 20. See, Mr. Singer? And then I mean to travel in a foreign country where there's snow.
Let's finish up the bottle. I want a small one, for we were thinking of freedom. That's the word like a worm in my brain, yes? No? How much? How little? The word is a signal for piracy and theft and cunning. We'll be free, and the smartest will then be able to enslave the others. But, there is another meaning to the word. Of all the words, this one is the most dangerous. We who know must be wary. The word makes us feel good. In fact, the word is a great ideal, but it's with this ideal that the spiders spin their ugliest webs for us.
The last one rubbed his nose. He did not come often, and he did not say much. He asked questions. The four people had been coming to his rooms now for more than 7 months. They never came together, always alone, and invariably he met them at the door with a cordial smile. The want for Antonopoulos was always with him, just as it had been the first months after his friend had gone, and it was better to be with any person than to be too long alone. It was like the time years ago when he had made a pledge to Antonopoulos and even written it on a paper and tacked it on the wall above his bed, a pledge that he would give up cigarettes, beer, and meat for 1 month. The first days had been very bad. He could not rest or be still. He visited Antonopoulos so much at the fruit store that Charles Parker was unpleasant to him. When he had finished all the engraving on hand, he would dawdle around the front of the store with the watchmaker and the salesgirl, or wander out to some soda fountain to drink a Coca-Cola. In those days, being near any stranger was better than thinking alone about the cigarettes and beer and meat that he wanted. At first, he had not understood the four people at all. They talked and they talked, and as the months went on, they talked more and more. He became so used to their lips that he understood each word they said, and then after a while he knew what each one of them would say before he began, because the meaning was always the same. His hands were a torment to him. They would not rest. They twitched in his sleep, and sometimes he awoke to find them shaping the words in his dreams before his face. He did not like to look at his hands or to think about them. They were slender and brown and very strong. In the years before, he had always tended them with care. In the winter, he used oil to prevent chapping, and he kept the cuticles pushed down and his nails always filed to the shape of his fingertips. He had loved to wash and tend his hands, but now he only scrubbed them roughly with the brush 2 times a day and stuffed them back into his pockets. When he walked up and down the floor of his room, he would crack the joints of his fingers and jerk at them until they ached, or he would strike the palm of one hand with the fist of the other. And then sometimes, when he was alone and his thoughts were with his friend, his hands would begin to shape the words before he knew about it. Then, when he realized he was like a man caught talking aloud to himself, it was almost as though he had done some moral wrong. The shame and the sorrow mixed together, and he doubled his hands and put them behind him. But they would not let him rest. Singer stood in the street before the house where he and Antonopoulos had lived. The late afternoon was smoky and gray. In the west there were streaks of cold yellow and rose. A ragged winter sparrow flew in patterns against the smoky sky, and at last came to light on a gable of the house. The street was deserted. His eyes were fixed on a window on the right side of the second story. This was their front room, and behind was the big kitchen where Antonopoulos had cooked all their meals. Through the lighted window, he watched a woman move back and forth across the room. She was large and vague against the light, and she wore an apron. A man sat with the evening newspaper in his hand. A child, with a slice of bread, came to the window and pressed his nose against the pane. Singer saw the room just as he had left it, with the large bed for Antonopoulos and the iron cot for himself, the big overstuffed sofa and the camp chair, the broken sugar bowl used for an ashtray, the damp spot on the ceiling where the roof leaked, the laundry box in the corner. On late afternoons like this, there would be no light in the kitchen except the glow from the oil burners of the big stove. Antonopoulos always turned the wick so that only a ragged fringe of gold and blue could be seen inside each burner. The room was warm and full of the good smells from the supper. Antonopoulos tasted the dishes with his wooden spoon, and they drank glasses of red wine. On the linoleum rug before the stove, the flames from the burners made luminous reflections, five little golden lanterns. As the milky twilight grew darker, these little lanterns were more intense, so that when at last the night had come, they burned with vivid purity. Supper was always ready by that time, and they would turn on the light and draw their chairs to the table. Singer looked down at the dark front door. He thought of them going out together in the morning and coming home at night. There was the broken place in the pavement where Antonopoulos had stumbled once and hurt his elbow. There was the mailbox where their bill from the light company came each month. He could feel the warm touch of his friend's arm against his fingers.